Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think a lot of people say, whoa, geez, that's a lot of money to be sitting around, but I don't think so. What happens if things go bad? Unless you don't care, unless you want to give it back to the bank when things go bad, you're just hoping. If your risk tolerance is, hey, you know what? If this market goes way down, I don't care if I lose my properties, I'll just build them back up. Well, then do what you want, fly by the seat of your pants. But if you want to be conservative, I would put in minimum of 6 months.
Hello and welcome to Pillars of Wealth Creation, where we talk about creating financial success with a special focus on business and real estate. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer. Now, let's get to it.
Are you ready to start investing in real estate today, but don't know where to start? Sometimes investing can seem way too complicated, but it actually couldn't be any easier than with homeinvest.com. You know the co-founder and my friend, Nate Armstrong. He appeared on episode 20, and if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it, episode number 20. Home Invest is a company that allows you to invest in turnkey real estate. Their goal is to build powerful investment tools that make real estate investing accessible to everyone. They have contractors and property managers available for you with the click of your mouse. While other real estate agents can only offer a property, Home Invest brings you a full turnkey package that allows you to diversify your investments, earn passive income, and start building equity in properties. Their simple, intuitive design allows newcomers and experienced investors alike to hit the ground running and to be able to choose the properties when they want and where they want. View easy to understand charts and data to allow you to buy in only a few clicks or just a simple phone call. With Home Invest, you'll be building your portfolio as quickly or as slowly as you would like. And right now, Home Invest is giving our listeners, Pillar of Wealth Creation listeners, a free course on how to finally win in real estate investing. So go to homeinvest.com/pillars. That's homeinvest.com/pillars to claim your free course today. Hello and welcome back to Pillars of Wealth Creation. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer. With me on these hump day hustles, as always, is John Stiles with Bridge Realty. John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Todd. The kids are back to school.
Really? Already?
Yep. I'm in the Minneapolis school district. And so They start August 27th for 1st through 12th, and then August 29th for my kindergartner.
Wow. See, I didn't think it was that. I didn't think that was a thing in Minnesota. I thought like you had to wait until after Labor Day. And I always heard it was because of our Minnesota State Fair. Sure. Like they didn't want kids to go back to school until the fair was done to be able to get more people to the fair. But yeah, my kids don't start until next week.
Yeah. I thought that most people did that or started later because of kind of the farm season, harvesting and whatnot. And then in Minneapolis, obviously we don't have any farms. So
well, a few,
some neighborhood, little gardens, but
yeah.
Farming going on inside the city here.
Well, interesting. Well, cool. They're back to school. So now, no more, there were kids at home during the day. So
we still have our 2-year-old. So
I guess. Yeah. Stay at home. You didn't send him to kindergarten?
No.
No, not yet. All right.
So, yeah. So hopefully to getting back on a better schedule, you know, I was waking up a little bit later during the summer, and now I take my kids to school in the morning, partially, you know, just to get me up and going.
Yeah.
And, they're at an early start school, so they start at 7:30. So We are out the door by 7, and I get to the office on time.
Oh, cool. Well, our kids don't start, I think, until 9 o'clock. So we're definitely not an early start school, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, awesome.
What about yourself? What's going on?
So I just got back from a real estate conference where I was on a panel. So that was kind of neat. spent some time doing that. It was fun. It was, you know, it was a crowd of about 500 people, and I got to be on this panel, and they asked a lot of different questions, very, very good questions. Talked about financing. So I talked a little bit about some seller financing, talked about syndication, and just, I guess some underwriting practices, all kinds of stuff. So it was fun. It was definitely enjoyable to be up in front and help, you know, share a little bit of what I've learned, of course, not only on my own stuff, but of guests that I've had. You know, now I've actually recorded, but we've released close to 100 episodes. I've recorded over 100 episodes. So, you know, I've talked to a lot of people that are, they're in the business and doing a lot of stuff. So I've got a lot of valuable insights between what I've done and what other people have done that I can share. So it was pretty fun to be up in front and do that. So that was in Chicago. So it wasn't too far away. It was 6 hours of a drive. I was going to fly, but the plane tickets were crazy expensive. I just couldn't force myself to spend that much money on a plane ticket. So,
sure. Well, that's really cool. What was the general topic of the panel that you were on?
Nothing. Oh. Real estate. It was just ask questions, audience asking questions. And so just, you know, an audience member would ask a question and either all of us answered or maybe one or two of us answered, depending on, you know, who had a position on it. So it kind of depended, but like I said, we talked about syndication. There was questions about syndication. There was questions about financing. There was questions about underwriting. There was questions about, you know, how do you find the market that you want to invest in? So all kinds of different kind of questions from the audience. So. It was definitely fun.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So today with this conference, it kind of came up a topic that I wanted to cover, and I had several people ask kind of the same thing, and I was on a forum and, it was Bigger Pockets, and somebody asked kind of the same type of similar question, and it's all about, you know, how do we cash flow? How do we make sure we cash flow? Not only today, but tomorrow, you know, when the market crashes, whenever that is, how do we maintain our cash flow and make sure that we're not underwater? And it just led me to, I think I've had a lot of these types of questions asked lately, and just, you know, a lot of people thinking about it different ways. And I think some ways, sometimes it's a little, you know, dangerous the way people are thinking. As the market continues to grow, we've got to be more and more sure about our investments, you know, and more careful about them. So that's kind of what I want to cover today.
Sounds good. Yeah, I mean, everybody's asking, you know, how long is this upswing going to last? Everybody's kind of worried about it. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, there's a lot of things you can do to either put yourself in a good position or a bad position. I got into real estate kind of after our last big crash. So I can't really speak from experience of going through a crash. But of course, you know, I've learned plenty from other people's mistakes. So
that's always good.
Let's kind of list a couple of things to keep in mind, or strategies or things you can hedge against being taken down whenever the market correction may happen.
Yeah. Well, first of all, here's what I'll say to the market correction. People have been predicting it for 5 years or some people even longer, right? And so they're going to be right eventually. There's several people I could name, which I'm not going to, that have been calling a real estate crash, down cycle, whatever you want to call it, for quite some time now. But here's the thing. If the numbers still work, then buy the piece of real estate. If the numbers still work, not if you're forcing the numbers to work, but if they still work, buy. When the numbers don't work or you have to force them to work, then don't buy. So I don't think at any time in the market cycle, you should stop at least looking. You should stop hunting. You should stop trying to buy because it's too hot, right? If you bought something, for one, you probably couldn't have found anything that great in 2006. But if you bought something in 2006 and you followed the right fundamentals, you were fine. If you followed the right fundamentals, if it still worked and you didn't force it to work. The problem is so many people forced it to work. They manipulated the numbers to make it work. And then they bought and they didn't follow the conservative fundamentals and then they got stuck. And that's where people get in trouble is when they force things to happen. So what can we do? I think first and foremost to me, you need to put yourself in a good cash position. And there's two things. One is cash flow and the other is equity or cash. If you don't have those, you're going to fail. And when a downturn happens, you're just going to fail. We can get by with it right now, right? People that put themselves in a poor cash position or a poor cash flow position and they bought in 2010, 11, 12 are doing fine right now. They're doing great. They look like heroes, quite frankly. They look like geniuses. If somebody bought in 2000, there's a lady in Indianapolis that was selling her portfolio. She bought these properties and I think it was like 2012 or 13, right? She overpaid for them at the time. She overpaid for them, didn't do her value add, didn't raise the capital she should have. She just did a poor job. But she just sold them. I looked at that portfolio and I tried to buy it, and that was the story that I was being told. So this is just a story from a broker. I don't know if this is a true story or not, but this is the story for the property. She ended up selling those properties, and they made a ton of money just because the market cooperated with them. But think if she bought those, let's rewind and say she bought those in 2005 and she bought those wrong. She did the exact same mistakes. What would have happened to her? Well, those properties would have all went back to the bank because we all know what happened in 2007, eight, by 2008 or nine, she would have had those properties. Those would have been back to the bank. So instead of you looking like a hero, she would have looked the opposite. And, you know, so yeah, can you hide a lot of things in a great market uptick? Yeah. But when we get closer to the top, and I would say we're closer to the top than we are to the bottom right now. I don't know where we're at. We might be in the sixth inning, you know, right now. We might be in the fifth inning. So we might have some room to go. But you want to put yourself in a good cash and cash flow position. I think that's the most important part.
Yeah, I mean, what you're talking about with people making numbers work is what that means is, you know, assuming that the values are going to continue to rise at the same rates or even higher rates. So if the value was 50,000 and now it's 100,000 and they're going to say, well, I'm sure it's going to be 150,000 next year or whatever. But then the correction happens and, you know, then you don't have that same value there to bank on. So, and then if you look at that with the rents, you know, maybe somebody bought it where they weren't cash flowing, say the rents were just using very basic numbers, you know, $1,000 a unit. And that wasn't quite paying the bills, but they're like, well, with the way things are going, I'm sure I can get the rents up and buy in 2 years, then we'll be able to cash flow. But if everything changes with the rental market and rents don't go up, then, you know, then you're left holding the bag.
So I'm plugging some numbers into a calculator here. I was making, I bought a duplex in 2009, right? And I was getting $750 per month for those units. Okay, so 750 times two is 1500, right? My cash flow on those properties at that time was about 350 bucks a month. So it was pretty good, right? I was doing all right. Well, Now today I'm getting $13.25 per unit, right? So now I'm getting $26.50. And the point of this is not to brag, right? I'm doing really well on that property right now. I'm getting an additional $1,150 on top of the $350 I was making. So that property, I'm crushing it every single month. Now I have some more expenses, right? My taxes have gone up. My insurance has gone up. My utilities have gone up, all that kind of stuff. So I'm not grossing an extra $1,150. I'm probably grossing an extra, let's call it conservatively, $950. But at the same time, when I tell a story like that and people hear that haven't been in the industry and that are going, I want to invest in real estate. And they hear that story and they go, holy crap, I can invest in real estate. And they go, I don't need cash flow now. Look what's going to happen. Well, we assume that just because I was able to do it from 2009, golden time to buy properties. By the way, at that time in 2009, everybody thought I was crazy for buying properties. That was the stupidest thing to do. But in hindsight, everybody goes, oh, duh, of course you bought properties in 2009. But from 2009 to 2018, if you can see, holy cow, look at those prices jump. I can do that. You know, I don't need to make money right now. Well, what happens when, let's call it 2020 hits? Okay, maybe that's our next cycle time. So 2020 hits and your rents went from 1325 up to, maybe they went up to 1400. So you're now all of a sudden you're cash flowing, you know, $75 a unit. Okay, but what happens when they go down now? And people go, well, rents just don't go down. Well, that's true. Rents don't go down typically. But what happens? Vacancies go up and concessions start to happen. We trick rents, right? In the real estate industry, we trick rents. Rents do go down. We just trick it from going down. So the statistics show that rents don't go down. Instead, we go from zero concessions to now offering 1 month, 2 months, maybe even more, maybe 2 months in a TV concession. Now from having, you know, this property's been at 100% vacancy or occupancy since probably 2010. Now from having, you know, 95% occupancy, now we're down to 85. So granted, my rent still is at 1400, but I'm not collecting it like it's at 1400. I'm collecting it like it's at 1000.
Yep.
No. So there's a big difference. Big difference.
Yep. And then, so what you've done is your effective economic occupancy is less.
Exactly.
You know, somebody's living there and paying the utilities, they're not paying for those 1 or 2 months that you've conceded in order to get them in the door.
Yeah. I don't mean to have this episode like a, hey, I'm scaring you, don't buy real estate type of thing. Just be smart about it. When somebody tells you that rents don't go down, really? You think that rents don't go down? Rents do go down. Economically, rents go down. Yeah, maybe the actual rent didn't go down. But the money you're collecting every single month or every single year did go down. And that's really all we care about. How much can we collect? We don't care about how much we can charge. We care about how much we can collect. Yep. And it goes down. It does it every single cycle. So,
and hopefully you've purchased your property in a very you know, great economy or area, for example,
economic diversity. Yeah.
Right. Some areas do go down.
Yep.
For like Detroit is probably the biggest example where, the economy was based on basically one industry. And then when that industry changed, you know, we have huge downturn in values and rents. Yep. And all the above. So
historically here are the two, within a city itself, let's just say the city's a good, strong, fundamental city, because that's what you're buying in. Of course, all my listeners are smart enough to know not to buy in poor cities that with poor economics. So they're buying in a good city. However, the two property types that tend to go down the most, everything goes down, but it goes down the most, are going to be your A-class or A plus class, and then it's going to be your D class. Those are the two. That's both ends of the spectrum. So your B and C, especially B. B is very stable. That B minus. That B minus. C plus. That's the most stable property type. You're going to lose some occupancy. You're going to have some concessions, but it's going to likely be the least. Now, could it get hit really hard? It could, but historically, it's been the most stable. So as you get closer to that A, even a B plus is going to be less stable likely than that, like that B minus. And then C minus is going to be less stable than a C plus, B minus. So that's kind of your most stable property, right in the middle, smack in the middle.
Yep.
So, yeah.
So kind of what we've covered here is don't count on appreciation.
Yeah.
If you get it, you know, that'll be great. It'll be gravy. But you need to make sure you're buying properties and holding properties that are going to survive whatever corrections may be on our horizon.
Yeah. So I had a person at this conference ask me, and this was after I was off of the panel, they came up and were talking to me. Good conversation, really good, insightful questions that it was two different people were asking me. So it was a lot of fun having the conversation, but they were, one of them asked me a question about, basically about, you know, how do I protect myself in a time like this? And I was talking about reserves and your reserve account and how we should make sure we're putting plenty aside for the reserve account. And what I suggest in a single family house, especially, is that you have a year worth of principal and interest that you're putting aside. So you're taking your principal interest payment, you take a whole year, and that goes into the reserve account and it doesn't get touched unless you absolutely need it. But you don't plan on touching that. And then in addition to that, you have reserves every single month that you're putting into that account. And I would do at least 10% of the gross income, but I would likely do more than that. It really depends on the property, but I would put in, you know, if it's a, let's call it a 1980 property that you did some renovations, but maybe didn't do every single thing. I'd put like 200 or so a month into a reserve account and keep on feeding that and keep on growing it. Because eventually you're going to have a roof that you need to replace. Eventually you're going to have a furnace that you need to replace. Now, if you took that property and you from top to bottom renovated it, could you put a little bit less in a month? Yeah, you could probably get by with like 150. But you should still make sure you're keeping that reserve account available. So that's kind of what I told them. Look, you need that reserve account. I would do 12 full months, you know, multifamily. Bigger multifamily, especially the bigger you get, you could probably put a little bit less than 12 months. Like most times I'm putting between 9 and 12 months of my mortgage payment into a reserve account. And then for my construction budget too. You know, I do my contractor budget. If they budgeted, let's call it $100,000, I'm going to put away an additional $10,000, so $110,000. So I'm going to go at least 20% over, $120,000. I'm going to go at least 20% over what my contractor says. So if they did, I'll correct what I said. If they gave me a $100,000 budget, I put $20,000 above that.
Well, that definitely sounds like a very conservative and prudent planning. So when you are underwriting a new purchase, is that the number you plug in for your reserves? Or, I mean, yes. It sounds like it depends on the building size.
Yeah. I mean, for my multifamily, you know, I'm putting in, like on my last deal I just did, it's a value add. We're not having cash flow from day one. We're basically, we might be able to break even month one. Starting like month 5 to 6, we should be able to make some money. But my mortgage payments are, I'm going to do it real quick. I don't have it directly in front of me, so I'm just going to plug it in here. But, my mortgage payments would be $190,000 in a year. And, that's my reserve account. So, well, my reserve account for that one was 185. So basically almost a year worth of reserves that I did on that. Now, if it was completely stable, everything was running well, I might, put 9 months in there. But
okay.
So it kind of depends on, and then on that one, my budget, I went 25% over my contractor estimate is what I budgeted for my renovation. Mm-hmm. So,
cool.
So yeah.
Definitely good to have those cash reserves. It can really seem funny. If you haven't had those cash reserves before, it can seem weird to have that much cash sitting around.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think a lot of people say, whoa, geez, that's a lot of money to be sitting around. But I don't think so. What happens if things go bad? Unless you don't care, unless you want to give it back to the bank when things go bad, you're just hoping. Just hoping you can. If that's what you believe in and that's your risk tolerance, which I think is stupid. I don't know why you would invest, but whatever. That's up to you. But if your risk tolerance is, hey, you know what? If this market goes way down, I don't care if I lose my properties. I'll just build them back up. Well, then do what you want. Fly by the seat of your pants. But if you want to be conservative, I would put in minimum of 6 months. Minimum. I think you're setting yourself up for failure if you don't put 6 months worth of reserves in. Mm-hmm. But personally, I would do more. Any more questions on like the reserves, John, or anything like that?
Well, I think just something to point out, I think a lot of times when you're getting financing, the bank will require a certain amount of reserves, probably 6 months, I believe.
Well, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and large multifamily are going to reserve or are going to require, close to 9 months.
Okay.
So that should give you a clue.
Yeah.
Right? If a multifamily, which is more stable than single family, okay, if multifamily lender is going to require 9 months worth of reserves, why then should you, even if your lender doesn't require it, even if you go with a small local bank that doesn't require anything, why should you think that you can get by with 0 months of reserves or 1 month or 2 months or 3 months when a large lender is going to require 9 months? Mm-hmm. Should be a clue.
Yeah. And so if you're raising money for that, obviously you got to budget that in and how much money you need to raise.
Much equity. Yep.
It's not just the down payment. It's not just the capital improvements. It's also those reserves.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. I see people that are raising money that will send me their underwriting. And they don't have that in an account. And some of them don't even have like their regular closing costs in that they're raising. I'm like, well, where are you going to get your closing costs? Where are you going to get your reserve account? Oh, I have to put that in there. It doesn't appear. Like, yeah. You have to put that in there. Like that's required. So when people think, oh, I can put a 20% down payment, I've got $200,000 to invest so I can buy this property for, what, $1 million? You're going to have more costs than just that.
Yep.
Yeah. Hey, I want to interrupt this episode real quick to talk to you about Nate Armstrong. Our sponsor, Nate Armstrong, he's with HomeInvest.com. And you want to get to know Nate. So go to homeinvest.com and just connect with Nate. Talk to him. Learn about his operation, what he's got going on. He's a turnkey provider, and it may not be right for you, but it could be the perfect fit. So it doesn't hurt. It's a free call, free consultation, just to figure out, what they do, what they have to offer. And worst case is you're going to meet a great person who's really well educated in real estate. He's done a ton of different real estate strategies and probably he's going to teach you a little bit, even on a short conversation with him. So go to homeinvest.com and connect with Nate's company. You're definitely not going to be disappointed. It's worth it. So thanks. And we'll get back to our show.
Cool. What's another strategy that we can keep in mind as we're in this good market on the upswing here still.
Yeah. So I think as far as property operations and kind of your fundamental underwriting, of course, be conservative on your rent projections. I think that's really important. Understanding if your rents are, like I said, if they're at 1325 and they used to be at 750. Now this is an extreme, right? Most of my properties aren't like that. This is in a market that has seen a lot of gentrification as well. So it's just everything worked out really well there. But even if your market's seeing a 5% bump in rents a year, I wouldn't assume that. If you can't make it work at current rents, just don't buy it. Unless there's, you know, at current market rents, I should say, at current market rents, don't buy that piece of property. So yeah, just be conservative on your rents, be conservative on all projections. If the market is at a 3% vacancy, I wouldn't underwrite it at 3%. I would underwrite it more closer to historicals. If historicals are at 7 or 6, well, then you better underwrite it at least at 6 or 7. And then same thing with your expenses. You know, I see too many people put in light expenses. Make sure your expenses are good. Just because here's a trick that a lot of sellers do. I know, surprise, sellers trick you. And brokers, by the way. They will put expenses, your monthly expenses. They'll give you monthly expenses, right? You look at that and go, oh, cool. You know, I can operate it at $20,000 a year for my maintenance and repair expense. I'm talking about maintenance and repairs. Maintenance and repairs, oh, 20 grand a month or 20 grand a year, that's cool. Great. So I plug that in my number chart. But then as I look down on my profit and loss, sometimes this is even not even on the profit and loss, by the way, and you have to ask for it. There's a capital repair account. And that means I did stuff like I replaced maybe appliances. I did carpet. Maybe I put some new windows in. Maybe I had to replace a roof and so on and so forth. Some of those are real capital improvements, but maybe there's other stuff that's not real capital improvements, like replacing carpet. Well, if it's just a unit turn, I got to consider that as a unit turn, not as a capital improvement. Same thing with, like, if I repainted something, same thing if I, maybe they said, well, I replaced some faucets. Well, if that's a maintenance item, it needs to go in my maintenance budget. So people try to trick you by putting extra stuff, and capital improvement is an expense. I don't care which way you slice it, it's still an expense. Still cuts into your profit, right? Just because I put it in one category versus the other, it's still an expense. So when you're doing underwriting, consider that. I would consider at least $1,000 a month for your repairs, maintenance, and unit turns, per unit. So people just, they will, should be $1,000 a month or at least 10% of your gross income. So people just put it in different categories. So there's on the underwriting side. Anything to add to that before I bounce to a totally different topic? Or not topic,
just to clarify what you said about the $1,000 a month per unit is per month is your what is your expenses or
your maintenance expenses, your maintenance, repairs, unit turns. That's your expense there. People hide that in the capital improvements a lot of times. And so if you see a number where it's like, you know, $300, $400, $500, you know, they're juicing the capital improvements. Maybe juicing is the wrong word because that sounds negligent, but it probably is negligent anyway.
Well, not everybody's a tax or accounting expert and knows exactly how to.
Right. That's it. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, whether it's intentional or not, it's good to dig into it and figure out what's really going on there.
Exactly. And quite frankly, some of it might not be truly intentional, negative to you. It just might be how they account for it. Mm-hmm. And so it's done that way. They're going to give you those numbers and it's up to you to figure it out. It's wolf against wolf. So that's how it is. So I'm going to move on then, John, if that's all right. I'll see you have something else to add.
No, go ahead.
Okay. So one thing I heard on Bigger Pockets, this was the forum. Somebody was, he bought a house, right? And they improved it. And he was asking, how much should I take out of this house? It appraised for, I think it was like 140 or 150. So let's just call it 150. It appraised for $150,000 and he's renting it for $900 a month. And that's kind of all the information he gave. And he said, should I pull out all my capital, you know, 80% of the 150, or, so that's 120, by the way, I think, or should I do a lesser amount? And a lot of people said, yeah, pull it all out, pull it all out. You got that equity sitting there. It's dead equity otherwise. Why wouldn't you do it? I don't agree with that. And I think that's very, I think that's going to be, you're going to be a bad thing if you do that. Because the question you have to ask yourself is, would you buy that house at $150,000? Would you buy it as an investor at $150,000? If the answer is no, then don't finance it based on that. Finance it based on what you would buy. So in this case, rent is at $900 a month. John, what would you buy a property without knowing much more than just that? What would you buy a property, just a knee-jerk reaction, at if it was renting at $900 a month? About what?
Yeah, I the quick and dirty calculation is the 1% rule, which, so that'd be about $90,000.
Okay, so $90,000. So if I'm going to buy it at 90, should I finance it at 120?
No. Well, depends.
Why? Why does it depend?
So I guess, I mean, I agree with you like 99%, but I would guess, you know, kind of depends.
You can disagree with me, John. I'm okay with that.
So
this is my show. You disagree with me.
You're fired.
Yeah. I don't want to see you ever again.
I would say, what are you going to do with that cash?
Mm-hmm. Okay, that could be a good point.
Are you going to go out and party? You're going to go buy mm-hmm. a yacht, or mm-hmm. I can't buy a yacht with that much money, but
probably not.
You know, or a new boat or whatever. Or are you going to use that money to improve the property so that you can increase the rents?
Okay.
Or you're going to use that money to reinvest in another property that's overall your global cash flow is going to increase to support the whole package. So I would put that caveat of what are you going to do with the money. But if you're just doing it for the sake of maximizing your leverage, then that's mm-hmm. probably not a good reason to do it.
Again, this is my opinion, so it's never right or wrong, by the way. My opinion on what you said, I agree on one point. I agree on the point of, if you can take that 120, you can improve the property and increase rents at least to that 1200, so you're making that 1% again, which actually, quite frankly, that wouldn't work for me either. Like if I had $1,200 a month in rent, I'd have to buy it about $90,000. Just would. Because my goal, my minimum on a single family is going to be $300, $250 to $300 a month in cash flow. So I would be closer to $90,000. But either way, if your fundamental is 1% rule, you're buying at 120, you'd have to be able to bump rents up to 1200. Now, what you said is, well, are you going to be able to buy another property that cash flows? Here's what I would argue on with that. Now, if you're going to take that, let's call it 120. Let's just say he was all in with cash, and so it was 120. If you're going to buy that, take that 120 and buy another property, and your cash flow is extreme, and you're not going to leverage that property very much, now it might work. But what most people do is they go and buy the next property, and then leverage the heck out of that property as well, and try to go do it again. And they keep on leveraging the crap out of properties until they either are done buying, or the music stops, the market crashes, and now they have zero properties, and they have, you know, $2 million of equity that turned into negative $500,000 in equity. That's what most people do. So that's why I disagree with you on that. I agree with you if you can do it the right way, but I don't think most people will ever do it the right way.
And I think that's what a lot of people did in this past.
Yeah, that's what people did in 2002 to 2006.
They just were playing the game while they could and leveraging everything as much as they could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're going to use history, man, I mean, come on, if people did it before and they lost everything, what's going to happen when you do it again? Like, I'm all for getting all of your equity out of a property. I got almost all of my equity, if not all of it, out of all my properties. But guess what? Every single one of my properties is leveraged at like 50% loan to value. I don't have things that are leveraged at 90% loan to value because I leveraged based on what I would have bought that property for max price. Hmm. And then I was able to pull my money out because I got great deals. But if you can't get great deals, you've got to leave some money into it. Hmm. Just plain and simple. I think it's crazy to be leveraging. So that's my advice. So for the listeners who want to take my advice, what my advice would be is here is plain and simple. Figure out what you would buy that house or duplex or apartment building. I don't care what it is. What you would buy that piece of real estate for. What's your max price? Okay. Based on the cash flow. What's your max price? And then leverage it based on that price. Okay. So if in this case it was $90,000, you're going to put a loan on it for 80%. So $72,000. Is that right? I think that's right.
I'm doing math in my head. So
yeah, pretty sure that's right. So you're going to put a loan on it for $72,000. That's the most you would put a loan on it. Could you squeeze that? Could you do 75? Yeah, you could probably do 75. Could you do 80? Maybe. If the cash flow works out, right? You still want to maintain your, and that's the other thing. Have a minimum cash flow. If you can't cash flow on a single family, $200 a month, I think you're going to set yourself up for failure. Unless you're seeing that you can actually increase the rents out of a forced value add. But if you're basing that on market rents and you can't cash flow $200 in a single family, I think you're setting yourself up for failure. I really do. So that's my advice. Take it for what it is. You don't have to listen to me. But I think if you want to keep your properties during a downturn, at least listen and try to figure out what's best for you, but maintain conservativeness. Is that a word?
Conservatism.
Yeah. Whatever the word is.
Yeah. So I think some people have done that with the single family houses. You know, they maybe are breaking even, but they're okay with it because they're just waiting for that single family market to get up to a certain value. And like you said, as long as you were riding that upswing, you know, that might work, but you never know when the market's going to flatten or go down. So you're really playing the market, and there's winners and losers in that game.
Yeah. Here's the danger with single family up to four family, one to four family. Here's the danger. It's based on emotional purchases. So what you're going to get is you're going to get prices that'll go up for a house based on emotions. It's not based anything on financials. Now, a fourplex, triplex, maybe you could argue a duplex, but I don't think a duplex. I think a duplex is pretty much all emotional. But a triplex and a fourplex, a little bit more on the numbers side. But a single family has zero financial appraisal value. I mean, so that's the problem. You can't do the same thing with a 100-unit complex, right? A 100-unit complex is appraised based on the numbers, not solely. I mean, it's got a little bit of other factors in it, but it's based on the numbers. Can you still over-leverage a multifamily? Absolutely. People do it all the time. But at least you can't do what you can do in a single family game. I mean, you could have a single family that can rent for $900 a month and it appraises for $250 a month. And if you want to leverage it, especially if you do it in your own personal name, you get an FHA and you get a 200 $100,000 loan, $250,000 loan, I mean, that'll never work, right? You're going to be losing $500 a month every single month, but you could do it.
Yep.
You know,
you better know going in that that's that you're going to be paying money every month. It's not going to be a cash flow. It's going to be, well, it's going to be cash flowing, just the wrong direction.
Yeah. And so I'm assuming I got really smart listeners. I think they all are. And I think everybody knows we don't buy on appreciation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So awesome. Well, that's kind of, I think that's my rants and raves for the day. I to me, it's just, it's all about trying to maintain that level of, we got to, what are we doing this for? We're doing it to make money, right? I think most people that are in real estate are trying to create some financial freedom, are trying to make some money, trying to get some cash flow. They're trying to do the things that are going to set themselves up for positive in the future. And if you're going about it wrong, you're going to set yourself up for failure. And don't think that you can get away with it for a little bit of time and then tone it back and be conservative later. And that's the wrong approach as well. I think people do think that too, like, oh, I'll just do it for a couple and then build myself up. And then I'll tone it back. That, I think you're going to get stuck. So.
Yeah. Well, before we wrap it up, just one other thing I wanted to mention is, you know, while rents are increasing in the market, you know, make sure that your building is staying up to date. So mm-hmm. I think the tendency is to just kind of let leases expire and then go month to month and then just kind of sit stagnant. So
I do that all the time, John.
Before?
Yeah, I do that all the time. I mean, on my own portfolio here, I don't pay as much of attention to it as I should because I focused on, you know, building my business and this podcast and stuff like that. And I do it all the time. Like I just had this property that I just mentioned, 1325 for rent. I just got it up to 1325 because my old tenants moved out. My old tenants were paying $1,050 a month. Yeah. So I was behind by a couple bucks. So if you think about it, for the last probably maybe last year I could have got 1275, maybe even 13. But if I would have been charging 1275 last year, you know, that's $225 every single month that I could have made that I didn't make. And so that's big, extremely big. So I'm glad you mentioned that, John. Make sure you're pushing your rents. You don't have to kill your tenants, but make sure you're pushing your rents to market and try to maintain that cash flow.
Yep. And obviously you need to do that with balance. You don't want to just suddenly give your tenants a huge increase that they can't afford it. And then you've got maybe a big turnover that you have huge expenses for. So you have to do that with balance. You kind of take into consideration how long the tenants have been there. Are they used to having rent increases? So, you know, that's why I try to, even if it's a nominal or minor rent increase, have it as a routine. So they expect every year the rent goes up, even if it's a couple of bucks.
But it adds up quickly because if your market is going up, let's say your market's going up 5% a year, which is happening in a lot of markets, it's happening on our market. And you're renting for $800 a month. Well, that's $40 in 1 year. So next year, when that lease expires, you should be charging $840. If you're not, and you keep it at 800, now the following year, if it increases by another 5%, that's, $882. Is that correct?
Whoever's the math.
Yeah. Whatever it is. So anyways, it's 880 plus.
Yeah.
So now you, instead of just having to increase $40, now you have to try to increase, you know, 85 ish. It's like, geez, that's a lot harder.
Yeah.
And now if you wait another year, again, it's even more now it's an additional, you know, nearly $50 additional. So yeah, you've got to do it every single year if you can, and maybe you don't quite get it up to market because you like that tenant a lot and you know they'll probably leave. So right. maybe instead of that 840, you bring it up to like 830. But you're already 10 behind, you know? So the next year, if you only bring it up 30, now you're 20 plus behind, and that continues. So.
And in practice, I don't really follow the market, because I do value stable tenants, and you know those tenants.
There is something to be said for that.
Yep, they may not have had the same pay increase or increase in their income. So
you just tell them to get better jobs.
if you have a big enough portfolio there, you can just have your job coach.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
For living there. So.
No, but there is some value for sure in what you just said there, John. I mean, if market goes up by 40, maybe you don't charge that extra 40. Maybe you charge an extra 30 or 25 because you do value the tenants you have. And you know that a move out is going to cost you a turn fee, which, you know, is even with the good tenant, it's going to cost you money. Even with the good tenant, you're going to have to do some paint touch up, some cleaning, maybe some other minor stuff. And so it's
agent.
Paying your leasing agent. I mean, so even in a good, with a good tenant, with a good turn, it's going to cost you several hundred dollars for sure. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of the tenants getting better jobs, you know, that might be something for our listeners to consider as well. Just while the economy is good, you know, take advantage of that. Look for your own pay increase. Look for your own second job or whatever it is to increase your cash flow aside from the rental, so that if there's any change in your rental income, then your own personal income has increased to help out your, again, the global cash flow there.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to make a little stab at the Uber drivers. As somebody said the other day, said they were talking about side hustle. They go, I don't know when becoming a taxi driver was a side hustle. You know, I thought it was pretty funny. They said something. How they said it was way funnier than what I just said. But they were just talking about, you know, people being Uber drivers now that's a side hustle.
Yeah.
But the point of what they said actually is, if you're going to choose a side hustle, try to choose a side hustle that can actually grow with you. And becoming an Uber driver is not a side hustle that can grow with you, because if you're going to become a full-time Uber driver, then what are you? You're a taxi driver. Mm-hmm. That's what you aspire to be. That's fine. But, you know, they're just talking about how when you create a side hustle, try to do it something that can become something big.
Sure.
So, well, I'm sure that was great.
Another episode right there.
So. That's a whole different episode. Right. Awesome, John. Well, I appreciate the topic. I think it's a great topic for people to think about. How can our listeners, you know, find out more about us and subscribe and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, we definitely like your feedback on this topic and on the show. Also, I've got a brand new microphone here that we're trying out. Hopefully you can hear me better. So let me know. The way you can do that is just comment below. If you're watching the YouTube video, comment right there. If you're listening on something like iTunes, you can typically comment there. You can give us a 5-star rating. That's what we would love to get from you. You can also find us on Facebook, so we can continue the conversation there and all kind of chip in and learn from each other there. So.
Yeah, so our Pillars of Wealth Creation Facebook page, you can go ahead and go there too. Yeah, definitely.
So
awesome, John. Well, I appreciate the time. You make it a great day, man. Make every day a Saturday.
You too.
Are you ready to start investing in real estate today but don't know where to start? Sometimes investing can seem way too complicated, but it actually couldn't be any easier than with homeinvest.com. You know the co-founder and my friend Nate Armstrong. He appeared on episode 20, and if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it. Episode number 20, Home Invest is a company that allows you to invest in turnkey real estate. Their goal is to build powerful investment tools that make real estate investing accessible to everyone. They have contractors and property managers available for you with the click of your mouse. While other real estate agents can only offer a property, Home Invest brings you a full turnkey package that allows you to diversify your investments, earn passive income, and start building equity in properties. Their simple, intuitive design allows newcomers and experienced investors alike to hit the ground running and to be able to choose the properties when they want and where they want. View easy-to-understand charts and data to allow you to buy in only a few clicks or just a simple phone call. With Home Invest, you'll be building your portfolio as quickly or as slowly as you would like. And right now, Home Invest is giving our listeners, Pillar of Wealth Creation listeners, a free course on how to finally win in real estate investing. So go to homeinvest.com/pillars. That's homeinvest.com/pillars to claim your free course today.